Before it became possible to get any movie ever made without moving your ass cheeks off a sofa cushion, before cinema popcorn began to taste only of cooking oil and salt, and way before the production values of hideous Hollywood funerals exceeded the production values of hideous Hollywood movies, there was paleo cinema.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema podcast number 34. This time around, I'm looking at comedies. Last couple of podcasts have been quite serious. I mean, I did the Big Awesome Worlds thing last time around. So this time I thought I'd kind of go a little bit light. And I am looking at three comedies from... Comedies from right at the end of the paleo cinema era, 1980 for two of them, and I'm stretching a point, and I'm going into 1981 for the last one, because I like the movie, even though it's very flawed in a lot of ways. I do like the movie, and because it's about movies, I thought I would add it. So how have you people been? We have been suffering from an incredible case of the flu. I don't know whether it was swine flu or not. It didn't kill us if it was, but last couple of weeks have been a little bit problematic for Sal and I. We had some time off work, we coughed, spluttered, and produced enough mucus to fill a hot tub. We're much better now, everything's fine. I've been working out in the yard, knocked down the side fence yesterday in preparation for a new fence going up, and at the moment I'm staring over into my neighbour's yard where he's got his boat parked. But it's winter here still, pretty shit weather. Everyone in Australia, I think, has or has had the flu. We're not sure what's going to come of that, but we live in interesting times. On with the podcast. I did get some feedback. Remember how I mentioned maybe last podcast, if not last podcast, then the podcast before, that I didn't get too much feedback from what we here in Australia know as the Shaky Islands, and the people on the Shaky Islands know as Aotearoa, and who most of you know as New Zealand. But I got an email from somebody in New Zealand who was listening to the podcast, so I'll just read through a bit of that for us. Okay, the guy goes by the handle of Fossil John, and he said, "Have spent the last 2 weeks catching up on listening to all of your Paleo Cinema podcasts available on iTunes. Just two or three to go now. Have really enjoyed the pre-1980 focus of your viewing, and there have been plenty of movies I've begun to seek out on your recommendations. I especially enjoyed the recent Wells episode, being a long-term fan. The final sequences of Lady from Shanghai still make my jaw drop with their sheer brilliance. I'd be interested to know what you think about the rediscovered version of It's All True, Wells' lost film from his South American foray in the 1940s. I've seen excerpts of this on YouTube, which look visually beautiful. Some of the sequences remind me of the look of both Jacques Tourneur and Val Lewton's I Walk with a Zombie, one of my all-time favourite films. I would love to hear an episode based around Zombie, Cat People, Seventh Victim. You know, to back quite a few episodes that you didn't have any listeners in New Zealand yet, so maybe I'm the first. It's really good to hear considered commentary in an Antipodean voice. Keep up the good work. I'm spreading the good word for you among my friends. Fossil John, Cambridge, New Zealand." Thanks for that, Fossil John. I'm always happy to get new listeners in New Zealand. Sal and I spent our honeymoon in New Zealand on the North Island, so it is one of the places in the world of which we are very fond. I'm not too sure where Cambridge is. I think it may be on the South Island. I'm pretty sure it's nowhere near my favourite town in New Zealand, Whakatane. Yes, there is a place called Whakatane in New Zealand. Look it up. WH sounds are pronounced with an F in New Zealand, so in the map it looks like Whakatane, but it's actually Whakatane. And while we were over there, we kept listening to the news broadcast just to hear the weather girl say Whakatane every now and then. The other thing I know about New Zealand, in the Māori language, the word for genealogy is, and they'll kid you not, whakapapa. I'm not making that up at all. That is the real Māori word for genealogy. Anyway, thank you, Fossil John. I'm glad. I'm going to look at Turner at some stage. I love some of his work. I already looked at, I believe I did in the podcast, Curse of the Demon, which was a Turner film. But going back on those early ones, I do want to do that. There have been a few other podcasts that have looked at it, but I'm sure I can bring something new to the game by doing that. And it's going into the book. I've got a little book of suggestions and things that I come up with looking at new projects for the podcast. And Jacques Turner fits right in there. Absolutely fits the paleo cinema thing perfectly. So thank you for the suggestion, and we will get onto it. But I also heard from our old friend Monty, just a quick email to say hello. Going back to Fossil John for a sec, I'll have to look up It's All True on YouTube, or try to find a copy of it somewhere. If anybody wants to drop me one, please let me know. But I have read a lot about It's All True, which was Wells' lost film from just after Magnificent Ambersons. It is covered extensively in Simon Keller's second volume of his biography of Wells, Hello Americans, and goes into a great detail about how that project came about and didn't quite end up being finished. I will keep an eye out for that, and I will look it up on YouTube. Anyway, into the podcast, comedy. I'm not sure what really brought this up. I wanted to change the tone a little bit. I don't want to do too many podcasts around the same kind of serious stuff or even the same kind of thing, so I am always looking for new things to do on there. And I thought, haven't done comedy enough. Here are the three movies I'm going to look at this time around. The first one is Airplane, which was known in Australia as Flying High, but in the US as Airplane, not from 1980. I'm also looking at a movie from 1981, because it was actually filmed in 1980 and came out in 1981. SOB, Blake Edwards' film, and also William Holden's last movie. And the third movie I'm looking at is one of the comedy classics of all time, Caddyshack. Going to look at that, talk about that, have a little bit of fun with it. Okay, so comedy is problematic. I mean, I know people who love Adam Sandler and love Rob Schneider movies, but I can't stand them. I think they're mean-spirited and horrible. So for them, they're hilarious. For me, not so much. I even remember once upon a time I saw a Christian stand-up comedy act. And fair enough. If you believe in God, fair enough. Good for you. But I really think that if you're a Christian stand-up comedian, you've got to look at your own people and take the piss out of them rather than taking the piss out of the people that don't believe. The Christian comedy act I saw was really bad. It was so careful. It was so respectful. Comedy, I think, by its very nature, is transgressive. Good comedy breaches bad taste. It challenges people to laugh in spite of themselves. It's something that really opens the envelope of acceptable behaviour in a society at its best. If a comedy or a comedian isn't doing that, then they're not doing their job. Comedy is the court jester of our society. It's the one genre that can say things that can be said by no other genre. It is the necessary heretic in our world. To varying degrees, all three of these movies do that. Maybe Airplane less than the other two. But I wanted to look at these comedies because I like them a lot. They're considered classics by a lot of people, with the possible exception of SOB, and have become a part of our culture in some ways. First one I'm going to look at, I'm going to flip a coin, a three-sided coin, and I think I'll talk about SOB first, because that, I think, is the one that's the least successful of the three, but I've got a great fondness for it for a number of reasons.
Felix, for the last 40 years, I've lived a life of dedicated debauchery. I've consumed enough booze to destroy a dozen healthy livers. I've filled my lungs with enough nicotine to poison the entire population of Orange County. I've indulged in sexual excesses that would make Caligula look like a celibate monk. I have, in fact, conscientiously, day in and day out, for more years than you've been in this best of all possible worlds, tried to kill myself. And I've never felt better in my life. So, if you're really going to end it all, I can show you a half dozen great ways to do it.
What'd you give him? Oh, a pinch of this, a dash of that. Sometimes referred to in the trade as a sleeping beauty boilermaker. Take no notice if he begins to levitate. It's a common side effect.
SOB is a 1981 film written and directed by Blake Edwards, starring Richard Mulligan, Julie Andrews, Robert Vaughn, Robert Preston, Larry Hagman, Shelley Winters, Loretta Swit, Robert Loggia, and William Holden in his last movie. The story is a sharply critical satire of the film industry and Hollywood society. The main character, Felix Farmer, played by Richard Mulligan, is a phenomenally successful producer-director who has just made the first flop of his career, to the dismay of the studio and the loss of his own sanity. After emerging from a period of shock and self-destructive behaviour, he resolves to save both the film and his reputation. With great difficulty, he persuades the studio and his wife Sally, played by Julie Andrews, to allow him to revise the film as a softcore pornographic feature. However, the egos of the filmmakers, the studio, and virtually everyone else in Hollywood continue to wreak havoc on the creative process. That's all from Wikipedia. I like this film for a number of reasons. First off, I always like movies about making movies. There are very few that I dislike. And this one I like because I like a lot of the characters in it, a lot of the actors as well. This was William Holden's, as I said, William Holden's last movie, and I've got a great fondness for William Holden, not only because we share the same birthday. I talked about Paris When It Sizzles in one of the previous podcasts, and the character he plays in this film, Tim Cully, who's a producer for the studios, is almost a continuation of the Richard Benson character he played in Paris When It Sizzles. He's got the same cynical attitude to Hollywood. He's witty and world-weary, but wise with it. And it is a lot of fun. There are aspects of this film, I should add, that don't work. I think some of the slapstick doesn't work. Julie Andrews, to an extent, doesn't work. She was married to Blake Edwards at the time, so we'll allow the fact that he put his wife and also his daughter, Jennifer, in the film. It does have that good transgressive credibility for a couple of reasons, one of which is Julie Andrews shows her tits. Now, for people who grew up watching Sound of Music and Mary Poppins and all of those schmaltzy, horrible, nasty musicals starring Julie Andrews, this is kind of transgressive. I think also it was probably a liberating thing for Andrews as an actress and as a human being to break out of the Pollyanna stereotype and to show her tits. And to be fair, and to be really honest, they are not a bad pair of boobs. Quite admirable, perky for a woman her age, eminently watchable. So I'll put that aside now and talk about the rest of the film. I could spend hours talking about Julie Andrews' tits, but I will not do so. It's a behind-the-scenes thing. There are nasty studio people. There's Robert Vaughn playing a studio head. Marissa Berenson's in there playing an actress who is having an affair with both Robert Vaughn as a producer and an actor she wants to work with, and she's going behind the scenes to cut a deal on that. There's Shelley Winters playing a lesbian Hollywood agent. There's Larry Hagman playing another movie studio executive. There's even Rosanna Arquette in one of her first roles playing one of the girls that Cully picks up on the highway who turns up at Felix's house while they're trying to help Felix get his shit together. And basically, every character, with a couple of exceptions, the two girls that are picked up hitchhiking, a couple of minor characters, there are only three characters in the film who have any kind of moral compass at all. And they are Tim Cully, played by William Holden, who is a lecherous studio executive, but with a certain perspective on life. There's Irving Finegarden, played by Robert Preston in great form, who is a Dr. Feelgood type of doctor who comes to help Felix Farmer when he has his nervous breakdown. I've got a little audio of Dr. Irving Finegarden, and I really like Robert Preston in this film. I think, like Robert Preston in a lot of movies, he looks like he's having a lot of fun making the film, and I think that enthusiasm comes across on the screen, but I'll just play that audio clip because I like it, and I think the dialogue in it is quite funny, and it works.
Moon of Monaco.
Hi, Doc, how is he?
Hey, Ben.
How is he?
Why is it nobody ever asks how the doctor is first? Did it ever occur to you that I could be sicker than the patient?
Irving, I'm sorry, okay?
Felix will survive, but for all you know, I might be terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God I'm not a surgeon.
Can you wait until I mix you a drink?
Barely.
Dr. Erb, please. Felix is going to be all right, isn't he?
He'll be fine.
Oh, good.
But I'm not so sure about you, Ben.
What's the matter?
You look like 180 pounds of condemned veal. Why don't you let me give you a vitamin
shot? No, none of your shots. Thank you.
Oh, you never know. It might help. Come to think of it, why should I give you a vitamin shot? I'm the one with the hangover.
Hi, hon. It's me. Any messages?
B12.
I don't want to talk to her. No.
B-complex.
Now, FYI only, I'm at Farmers.
Crude liver.
Okay, all good.
And a generous jolt of adrenal cortex. Chased by a Bloody Mary. L'chaim.
I thought that was a chaser.
Mm-hmm. Where would Soccer Pasteur be if they hadn't taken chances?
Well, you guys got to help me. I got to get a story straight for the press.
Tell him you'll only be in the hospital a couple of months.
Oh, fuck off. Will you leave that crap?
Now,
forgive me, I'm sorry.
Lila.
You want a drink?
In order to inject this properly, I have to expose my gluteus maximus.
Want me to do it for you?
Are you perchance a nurse?
No. I used to be a junkie.
Would it endanger your amateur standing if I ask you to use a sterilized needle?
You're the doctor.
Now, I'm not that big a fan of Blake Edwards movies in general. Pink Panther movies left me cold. I can't stand Inspector Clouseau. I didn't like 10 because I found Dudley Moore's character such a wussy, wimpy, ugly little son of a bitch. But SOB is a favourite of mine. And one of the things is, by the way, the third voice you heard on that audio clip was the other one of the three wise men of the movie, a guy called Ben, played by Robert Webber, who was playing against type. He normally played nasty characters, and he was playing a bit of a nervous, wussy kind of character in the film. But they're the three people with a moral compass in this film, which is really unusual, and under normal circumstances, they'd be totally disreputable characters. But in this one, compared to the more mainstream type characters who are all utter bastards, including the Sally Miles character played by Julie Andrews, turns out to be a monstrous hypocrite at the end of the film when Felix, after he unfortunately dies, has a great big Hollywood funeral. And I thought another reason for doing this film was, of course, that Hollywood funerals are on everyone's mind at the moment after a recent debacle along those lines. But I do enjoy the film partly because it brings in a dramatized version of a Hollywood legend. Now, there is a legend that when John Barrymore, the great dramatic actor, died, his body was stolen, some say by Humphrey Bogart and Peter Lorre, some say by Raoul Walsh, some say it wasn't stolen at all. But the story goes that the body of John Barrymore was stolen and put into Errol Flynn's house with a cigarette in his hand and a drink in his other hand, sitting on an armchair, so that when Errol Flynn came home, and Flynn was a great friend of Barrymore's, he'd see John Barrymore sitting in a lounge chair with a drink and a smoke in his hand when he came through the door. And, of course, he freaked out when this occurred. The story is in Flynn's autobiography, My Wicked, Wicked Ways. It's also in Raoul Walsh's biography. And Walsh also mentioned it in a documentary he did, The Men Who Make the Movies, in 1973 with Richard Schickel. They dramatise this because the three friends of Felix Farmer, Cully, Ben, and Dr. Irving Feingarten, steal his body, not so that they can pull a practical joke, but for a much more benign and much more amiable reason. They want to give him a proper funeral, not the usual kind of Hollywood bullshit funeral that they knew would occur where his family got hold of it. So they swap the bodies and put an old character actor who died on the beach outside the beach house where most of the plot takes place. They put him in the Felix Farmer character's coffin so that he gets the big Hollywood funeral that he deserves for being a good, solid character actor. And they arrange a Viking funeral for Felix, which turns out to be quite a touching moment in the film. They put him in a boat, soak him in kerosene, and set it on fire while he's wearing a Viking helmet that somebody gave him during the making of one of his films. And they cross-cut between the big, full-of-hype, bullshit Hollywood funeral and the small boat Viking funeral that his friends give the Felix Farmer character. And I kind of like that part of the film. I like the fact that these three characters do the right thing. They're kind of a parallel. There's an English long-going TV series called The Last of the Summer Wine, where three disreputable old men in a small English village go and pull pranks like they're 17-year-olds and basically keep themselves amused in life. And there's a touch of that in the way that the three characters in this film act. They haven't entirely grown up, but they have a certain perspective on life. They've got a certain amount of wisdom. They've made their accommodations to the bullshit of the industry they work in, and yet they live life by their own code. And that, even though this is a silly comedy, it doesn't work a lot. There's a lot of slapstick things and car chases and car crashes, and some of the characters don't work, and some people seem to be in a different movie than everybody else. The main core plot of the film I quite like. I won't talk too much more about that, but if you haven't seen SABC, the whole film is on YouTube in about 8 parts. So if you don't want to fork out any money, but you can fork out a bit of bandwidth, type SAB movie in there, and you get past a couple of other movies called SAB, and you'll find that all 8 parts of the movie are on YouTube. So please indulge and enjoy if you choose to. I'm going to take a little bit of a break, and then in a moment I'm going to talk about the second movie, Airplane, also known as Flying High.
Put yourself in this man's place. Aboard a transcontinental plane, suddenly half the passengers, including your own son, are struck by a paralyzing, deadly illness. And then in the midst of the panic and confusion, the stewardess tells you to come forward to the pilot's compartment. This is what you find. A pilotless plane running wild in a stormy sky.
Can you fly this airplane and land it?
No, not a chance.
You're the only chance we've got.
How could he fly a plane again after the horrible experience that had sapped his courage and ruined his life? But only he, among all the passengers, had any chance at all to save them, even though it was 1 in 1,000.
This is Cross Canada Charter, flight 714, in distress. Come in, anyone.
I want you to get on a horn and talk this guy down. You'll have to talk him onto the approach. And so help me, you'll have to talk him right down to the ground.
As you might have gathered, that is not the trailer to Airplane. It is the trailer to the movie of which Airplane is a comedy remake. The movie was called Zero Hour, and it was made in 1957, starring Dana Andrews, Linda Darnell, and Sterling Hayden, playing the role Robert Stack played in Airplane. The movie was made by David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. ZAZ, they're normally called, or ZAZ, if you're an American. And it stars Robert Hayes, Julie Haggerty, Leslie Nielsen, Robert Stack, Lloyd Bridges, Peter Graves, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Lorna Patterson. The clip I just gave you the plot. Everybody knows this film. The Zucker Abrams Zucker brand started a few years before this with a theatre group called the Kentucky Fried Theatre, who then went along to make a movie that was quite successful called the Kentucky Fried Movie. Everybody's seen it. It's part of it is a long pastiche of Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon, but there are a lot of other comedy things, and the Zucker Abrams Zucker comedy brand is a style of comedy that has its roots way before these guys came along in things like Olsen and Johnson's Hell's a Poppin'. They've got a touch of Marx Brothers about them. They've got a whole bunch of comedy tropes that basically define their style. I went to their unofficial website, and I've got a list of the things that kind of define the Zucker Abrams Zucker style. They never try to do two jokes at the same time. When Leslie Nielsen delivers a punchline, he always does it straight. He never tries to be funny on top of that. Likewise, if there's something going on in the background, the foreground action must be straight. And if there's comedy in the background action must be straight. The second thing that defines it is a joke happening in the background must be related in some way to the action in the foreground. So a good illustration of this is basically when in Airplane, when someone says the shit's going to hit the fan, and then they cut to the place where all of the airline executives and things are, and a turd hits a fan. So the jokes have to relate, jokes in the background have to relate to the foreground. They can't just be random jokes thrown in with no relationship to the foreground stuff. Actors in the foreground must ignore jokes happening behind them. In Airplane, Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges engage in an argument while behind them watermelons crash down from the ceiling and spears thud into the walls. One of the other things is breaking the frame. It's usually not a good idea to remind the audience that they're watching a movie, but Robert Hayes gets away with it in Airplane after Julie Haggerty scolds him in an early scene. He turns to the camera and complains to the audience about his plight. The movie has to be a strong one to withstand more than one or two of these, because you run the risk of breaking the spell. The suspension of disbelief is of prime importance, much as it was during the Bush administration. The next rule is Jerry Lewis. We don't do anything Jerry Lewis would do. So that's basically it. They've got their own defined style, and you'll see that style being used by lesser comedy things. If you have a look at something like disaster movie or superhero movie or Meet the Spartans or any of those kind of comedies of pastiche, popular films or popular film genres. They pretty much use the Zucker Abrams Zucker style, but the topical jokes are a bit too topical. They date very quickly. It takes about 12 months for the jokes in half of these movies to date. They do break the fourth wall way too often. It is a style that is easy to do badly, but not easy to do well. And Zucker Abrams and Zucker did it in a number of other films. They did all the Naked Gun movies. They did Top Secret, which is a classic spy comedy, and also Val Kilmer's first film. But anybody else who tries it seems to do it badly. Airplane itself is a lot of fun. It was a breakout role for the second career of Leslie Nielsen. People saw him as a kind of stolid mainstream dramatic actor up until that point. He was doing TV movies and things like that. He started out doing things like Forbidden Planet and a few other smaller dramatic roles after coming out of Canadian radio. But Airplane basically started him as a slapstick comedy twit at an age where a lot of people are looking at bringing their career back. His career took off, and he's still to some extent doing the same kind of total fuckwit roles that he did in this film playing the Doctor. A surprising amount of the dialogue for Airplane came directly from Zero Hour. The way they found the movie was that Zucker Abrams and Zucker used to leave their VCRs recording late-night TV in California. They'd just leave a VCR tape on long record overnight, see what they can take the piss out of in the next project, and they happened to record Zero Hour and thought, you know, this is great, we're going to have to do something with this. So we were originally going to do a movie which was a pastiche of television commercials, but they liaised with the studio. The studio didn't like that either, but they did like the idea of doing Zero Hour as a comedy. And so on a fairly small budget for a studio film, they made this movie. And if you listen to the commentary track, there's a lot of nice background stuff that the guys talk about, the way they did things, how small the budget for some aspects of the film were, and how the studio got pissed off when they made a 2/3 size mock-up at the front of a 747 just so they could crash it through a window, and a few other bits and pieces like that. But going back to the Zero Hour, I've got a little bit of audio that I pinched off YouTube which compares the dialogue in Zero Hour to exactly the same dialogue in Airplane. I'll just play that for you just to give you a bit of an idea of how closely a serious dramatic B-film from the 50s goes against a 1980 comedy.
Joey, here's something we give our special visitors. Would you like to have it?
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
You ever been in the cockpit before?
No, sir. I've never been up in a plane before.
How do you like it?
Swell.
Joey, we have something here for our special visitors. Would you like to have it?
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Sure. You ever been in a cockpit before?
No, sir. I've never been up in a plane before.
Have you ever seen a grown man naked?
Don't you feel anything for me at all anymore?
It takes so many things to make love last. Most of all, it takes respect. I can't live with a man I don't respect.
Don't you feel anything for me at all anymore?
It takes so many things to make love last. Most of all, it takes respect. And I can't live with the man I don't respect.
What a pisser.
What was it we had for dinner tonight?
Well, the main course was meat or fish.
Yes, yes, I remember I had meat.
What was it we had for dinner tonight?
Well, we had a choice, steak, fish.
Yes, yes, I remember. I had lasagna.
Johnny, how about some more coffee?
Johnny, how much more coffee?
No, thanks.
I think you ought to know what our chances are. The life of everybody aboard depends on just one thing. Finding someone back there who not only can fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner.
I think you ought to know what our chances are. The life of everyone on board depends upon just one thing. Finding someone back there who can not only fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner.
I gotta get out of here! I gotta get out of here!
got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here.
Calm down. Get a hold of yourself.
Stewardess, please let me handle this.
I've got to get out.
Calm down. Now get back to your seat. I'll take care of this. Calm down. Calm down. Get a hold of yourself.
Doctor, you're wanted on the phone.
Doctor, I ask everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I was a fighter pilot in the war, but I flew little combat planes with only one engine. This has four. There's no comparison. The flying characteristics are completely different. It's a different kind of flying altogether.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Of course, Zero Hour wasn't the only influence on Airplane. There were the airport movies that came out from 1968 onwards based on Arthur Haley's novel. So there were a lot of other tropes that came in, the sick kid on the airplane with the nun and the guitar, all those sorts of silly things that were in 1970s disaster films. But flying high, come airplane, whatever you want to call it, I knew it as flying high when I first saw it in Sydney in 1980, is a lot of fun as a comedy. I think it doesn't bear watching too much. I watched it a couple of times for the podcast, and the second time around, even with the commentary track on, it seemed a bit weaker. You were waiting for the punchlines to show up. You were waiting for the jokes and the things. So I think it's got a limited ability to be rewatched. But in spite of that, it's a classic comedy. I was sitting down watching it with Sal. She's currently doing things at the moment. Otherwise, I would have got her involved in talking about it. But she'll quote every single funny line from Airplane verbatim. It's one of those movies where everybody knows the punchlines, you know. Surely you can't be serious. You know, yes, I am, and don't call me Shirley, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's an incredibly popular film. It's accessible. It's not particularly a transgressive comedy, except in the way that it takes the piss out of disaster movies, particularly airplane disaster movies. In that sense, I suppose it is transgressive, but maybe less so than the other two films I'm going to talk about today, SOB and Caddyshack. Nonetheless, classic comedy. Everybody should have it in their collection. I suppose I would have enjoyed it more had I been a little bit drunk. I think it's a movie that does go well with pretty much any kind of alcohol that hits your blood-brain barrier quickly. Fortunately, in this podcast, I think I'm going to be talking about three films that everybody's seen, pretty much. So there won't be too much to recommend in these ones that people haven't seen. But nonetheless, Airplane, got to mention it. It is a lot of fun. And I do want to see Zero. I haven't been able to get a copy of that. So if anybody wants to burn me and send me a copy of Zero Hour, just drop me a line and we'll work it out, because I would be interested in seeing the film. I kind of like Dana Andrews in a lot of movies, and it sounds like that's the kind of silly melodrama that I wouldn't mind putting on the DVD player in an afternoon and just enjoying it at the level it's supposed to be enjoyed. And I'll be talking about Caddyshack in a moment, but first I'm going to grab off YouTube the audio for a clip called Caddyshack in 1 minute. So I'll play that, then I'll come and talk about Caddyshack.
Take drugs, Danny?
Every day.
Good. Be the ball.
That was kind of incredible.
I'm looking at you.
Kill every gopher. Let's go while we're young.
How about a nice cool drink?
$1,000, you missed that putt.
Oh. License to kill gophers.
I smell varmint, Poontang.
Freeze, gopher!
Duty! Ahoy, Polloy.
How about a Fresca?
Oh. No, I really...
Oh, there's my phone. Oh, my arm. It's broken. Everybody, we're all gonna get
late. Caddyshack is a classic. It's about one of the only two golf films that I like, with maybe an exception for Glenn Ford in the Ben Hogan story from the 1950s. But Caddyshack, Banning, which I mentioned last podcast, and the Ben Hogan Story are pretty much the only golf films worth anything at all. The origin of the film is quite interesting. A few of the alumni from National Lampoon, including Doug Kenny and Brian Doyle Murray, who was doing the National Lampoon Radio Hour at the time, got together, and Doyle Murray, who's the brother of Bill Murray, there were about five brothers there. They've got as many brothers as the Baldwins, with a couple left over. But he was talking about his days as a caddy when he was a kid. He came from a large Catholic family, as you might understand, given that there are five brothers. And Brian Doyle Murray kind of used to tell stories about being a caddy. Him and Doug Kenny got together and put together the script that would ultimately be Caddyshack. It was voted as one of the 50 greatest comedies of all time in 2006 by Premiere magazine. And a lot of great stuff in here. Of the three movies that I'm talking about this podcast, this is the one that bears repeat viewing more and more each time I watch it. Some of the names are quite good too. I mean, there's Cindy Morgan's character, Lacey Underall, which is a great name for a femme fatale, seductress type of woman living by her own standards and putting it about a bit. And also, of course, the great Rodney Dangerfield, his character of Al Cervic. I'm not sure what they have in the letterbox at his place, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't say the cervix. So, and, you know, there's Michael O'Keefe playing Danny, the kid who wants to get on, but is currently trying to raise money for his college tuition by being a caddy at the country club where Ted Knight's character, Judge Smales, is the president of the club and wants everything to stay traditional and basically is the villain of the piece in a lot of ways. I'll just mention a few of the things about the film that I like. All of the dialogue that Bill Murray did as Carl Speckler, the greenskeeper, assistant greenskeeper, was pretty much improvised by Bill Murray. He just ran with it. He'd go over to the garden and say, I want to get three rows of chrysanthemums planted there and I'll just improvise something while I'm bashing them with a garden rake and pretending it's a golf club. So they did that. Worked really well. The only person who had any problem at all with the improvised style of things was Ted Knight, who everybody loved him. He was a nice guy, apparently, and a great character actor, but he really had trouble when people went off the script. He really couldn't handle the improvised style of it, and he kind of got fed up with the way everybody else was just playing around with the text, particularly people like Rodney Dangerfield, who just do one-liners like bam, 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 one-liners everywhere. And Harold Ramis, who directed the film, and Chevy Chase and Bill Murray, who didn't get on. Chevy Chase and Bill Murray really didn't get on in real life. They had a feud going back to the Saturday Night Live days. So that one scene that they're in the movie where Ty hits a golf ball into Carl's shed and they end up sharing some really bad wine and some of Carl's special marijuana, which was crossbred with Kentucky bluegrass, all of that was improvised by those two, even though they didn't like each other. All of Carl's dialogue was improvised by him. Originally, they were going to try to do a traditional style gopher for the film as well. The gopher was really going to be a little less cartoonish, but they kind of decided to go with the cartoon thing, and the gopher itself and all of that kind of stuff in the tunnels and with the little gopher puppet and all that was made by John Dykstra, the same guy who did the special effects for Star Wars a few years earlier. If you'll notice when you watch the film stock used in the gopher scenes, in the gopher tunnels, is of a higher quality than the film stock used for the general movie, so the film quality ups a lot when you see the gopher. And it works. I mean, it's the comedies, there are serious parts to it, and you can see, if you look carefully, you can see how the film evolved from having the emphasis on the Danny character and his life as a golf caddy and things like that. And the film's name, Caddyshack, it's about the caddies. But these fantastic comedians and actors came in and the film's emphasis skewed away from Danny towards the Ty character, played by Chevy Chase and Carl Speckler and Al Cervic and all those sort of things, just because those guys brought such energy to the film. And for that reason, the structure of it seems a little odd when you watch it a few times, but you just go along with it. It's a crazy, fun film to watch. Getting back to this Carl character played by Bill Murray, this was a breakout role for Bill Murray. People in the studio system saw that he could carry a film after he did Caddyshack, there were a few missteps. If you ever saw the remake of Razor's Edge starring Bill Murray in a serious dramatic role previously played on the screen by Tyrone Power, you'll see where that film, even though it's interesting to see Bill Murray in a serious role, doesn't quite work. It's a very earnest and stodgy kind of film to watch. But things like Groundhog Day and Scrooged and all those movies that really brought Bill Murray into being a box office star started really with Caddyshack. It was an opportunity and a great role. One of the weird things about the Carl character that I mentioned is, if you ever see any of the documentaries about Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, it's scary how Brian Wilson, having had all of his problems and his drug abuse and all of his other behavioural issues, if you see film of Brian Wilson, he sounds scarily like Carl Spackler in Caddyshack. I don't think it's a deliberate thing. I think it's part of the brain damage slurring the speech. I really couldn't take Brian Wilson seriously after that. I mean, yeah, he's a musician who's gone through all sorts of traumas in his life and things like that. But I had a kind of disconnect watching those documentaries about him because he sounded exactly like Carl Spackler in Caddyshack. I don't really think that the Carl character is cruel satire on people with any kind of brain damage. I think he's, yeah, apparently he is a Vietnam veteran and apparently he is a little shell-shocked and things, but I do like his worldview where he sits there washing golf balls and mumbling about the MILFs on the golf course and having fantasies about winning the US Open and all that sort of thing. There's a kind of gonzo vitality to the character that kind of defies people to say that he's making a cruel piss take on people with some kind of brain damage. I think the character is more like Wile E. Coyote than he is like a serious human being character. He's kind of like Wile E. Coyote with libido. Little bits and pieces where he's wandering around singing under his breath the Ballad of the Green Berets while he's making little bunny rabbits out of plastic explosive to blow up a gopher. It's just pure gonzo comedy at its best and one of the great comedy roles of the late 20th century. The Thai character played by Chevy Chase is a lot cooler. The kind of role Chevy Chase played in another National Lampoon movie a few years later, Vacation, kind of suits his style a little bit better than the suave Thai character, you know, the millionaire playboy who just golfs for fun and doesn't really try at anything. I definitely think that the Clark Griswold character works better because he's got more to play off with that kind of a character. He's a wannabe sophisticated who's really just a nerdy dad. It's a pity that those movies aren't in the paleo cinema thing. I stretched a point putting SOB into paleo cinema, but those National Lampoon Vacation films, and one film I may talk about in the future, Animal House, which predates Caddyshack but is pretty much in the same National Lampoon gonzo style, are classic comedies. They're kind of, to their time, what movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Pineapple Express and Zack and Miri Make a Porno and a movie I saw yesterday, The Hangover, are to contemporary comedy. I think that films like The Hangover and A 40-Year-Old Virgin, all those Judd Apatow kind of comedy things, owe a debt to the National Lampoon background. They've got that kind of abusing the people who abuse their power kind of emphasis on things. 40-Year-Old Virgin, I think it's a more gentle style of comedy. But just the general doper comedy kind of thing, and particularly a film like The Hangover, which is hilariously funny, and I recommend you see, are the natural evolved children of films like Caddyshack and Animal House and National Lampoon's Vacation and European Vacation and Christmas Vacation, all of those ones. I think there's a continuum of comedy there that I really like the style of. Yeah, I also like British comedy. I like a lot of the comedies of manners and things like that, the Ealing comedies and all those sorts of things. But out of the evolutionary and revolutionary changes of the 1960s and 70s came out this new style of comedy, which to a certain extent all three of these films is a part of. I think SOB's more old school. Blake Edwards trying to be hip and not quite succeeding. Airplane's another bunch of It's more kind of like Jewish nerd comedy with Zucker Abrams and Zucker just using as their references popular media and the style of comedy Caddyshack is, which is a comedy about class. It's about the rich versus the poor. It's about, you know, dedication versus idiocy, and it's also about having a lot of fun and enjoying your life. The characters who are antagonistic in Caddyshack are the characters that seem to have a lot but don't seem to be enjoying it, whereas people like Al Cervic is quite rich and he's enjoying his life. Ty, in his own way, is enjoying his life. And even the people like the Danny character, the kid trying to get ahead, is enjoying his life while he is on Struggle Street. The axis on that particular comedy is people who embrace life and people who try to repress it. And I think that kind of dynamic works really well given the characters involved in that. This podcast is going to go just a little bit short. Don't have too much else to say. It's really hard to dissect comedy in some ways. It's like analysing a soap bubble. If you fuck around with it too much, it's not going to be there anymore. And I think comedy is pretty much the same thing. You can only go into it to a certain level without the comedy part just vanishing in the blitz of words you put around it. So if anyone else has any other comedies to mention, I mean, there are a couple of things I really want to see that I haven't had a chance to pick up yet, but I will do. Movies like The Ruling Class with Peter O'Toole, a great comedy from 1971, which is very dark in places. I may talk about that in a future podcast as well. And there are any number of them. But again, comedy is so subjective. It's a hard thing to say everybody's going to like this because that simply won't be the case. So let me know what you think. KULTGURU@gmail.com. And I'm going to leave you guys with a contemporary bit of comedy song from The Family Guy. It's Frank Sinatra Jr. and Seth MacFarlane singing a swinging song much in the style of the Rat Pack. So I'll just leave you with that. It's not a particularly long clip, but just in the mood of the comedy, I thought I'd leave it an up note. Let me know what you think about this one. I'll be back again in 3 weeks with Who Knows What. In the meantime, enjoy your movies. Share the love with the people you like. Recommend films to people. That's why I'm doing this podcast. Let other people know what you enjoy and let other people know what the total shit is and don't let them waste their time watching it. So that's about it. I'm going to leave you with a clip now and 3 weeks from now, I'll be back talking at you.
How I love a girl who's flawless, even better when she's braless. But the thing that tops it all is when we swing. And how I love a glass of Jack, or anything with Robert Stack. But the gals we romance can't stay out of our pants when we swing. Yesterday had got me feeling kind of blue. So you left and we replaced you with a Jew.
Lady!
You're fired.
Oi!
We love it when the ladies squeeze us. That's an easy way to please us. But we feel like freaking Jesus when we swing. I love the work of Alan Funt,
or a nicely shaven leg.
But nothing compares to the feeling that we get